You're tuned to WFHB
91.3
and 98.1 FM.
Volunteer powered,
listener supported.
Community radio for South Central Indiana.
Welcome to WFHB's Daily Local News.
Written and produced entirely by volunteers from the Bloomington community.
And supported by the generosity of listeners like you.
Good afternoon from the studios of Community Radio WFHB. I'm your host, Wes Martin. In today's edition of the Daily Local News, we'll continue our retrospective on the best stories and reporting from WFHB in 2017. We start with a piece from November, when I spoke with Indiana University Foundation President Dan Smith about a New York Times allegation that the IU Foundation has tens of millions of dollars invested in offshore accounts. Smith, who's also the former dean of the IU Kelley School of Business, says the foundation is invested in a so-called blocker corporation in the Cayman Islands. So the Times article alleges that through the Paradise Papers, they've found out that about $10 million or so in investments is invested in a blocker corporation in the Cayman Islands. And what purpose does an investment like that serve? Is that part of this mitigating cost and increasing return?
Right. Yes. So if you think about what this blocker, and I mean, that's just a term of art, I guess, a blocker corporation, we give them money, and I'll make an adjustment on the $10 million in a minute. It's a little bit less than that at the moment, but we invest with them, with a blocker corporation, and that blocker corporation takes our money, and they reinvest it in multiple opportunities, not just in the Cayman Islands, but all over the world for that matter. And the benefit there largely is that it reduces our administrative costs. Think about it as an individual. We could buy 10 different shares of stock from different companies, Apple, General Motors, IBM, and so on. But gosh, we got to keep track of all of that and, you know, manage the taxes on certain dividends. If we have investments, let's say in treasury bills, that interest income is taxed at a very low or oftentimes zero rate, whereas dividends from, say, IBM are taxed at normal income rates, and yet there's another tax called capital gains tax that's taxed at another rate. So there's a lot of administrative work behind the scenes in investing, and so a blocker corporation, first and foremost, just allows us to provide them the funds. They invest them. And we follow how they invest them, and then we get the returns after taxes, and then we get some of the principal back over time also. And so right now, I just checked on this, Wes, this morning, and right now we're down to now about $3 million with that blocker corporation that the New York Times talked about. So $3 million, you know, on a $2 billion portfolio, I mean, it's less than 0.25%. So it's really a pretty modest level of investment, but that's why we do it, is it helps us provide, lowers our taxes, but it also lowers our administrative costs. And all of that creates more money. I want to go back to the beginning, creates more money for students and faculty support.
Thank you very much for correcting me. It's $3 million, not $10 million.
No, it's fine.
Is that investment in this so-called blocker corporation, did that come from the endowment or was that gifted to the endowment?
So yes and yes. So all of the gifts that come to the endowment come in from gifts. Okay, it's all gift funds, if you will. So you may write a check, and I may write a check to Indiana University to create, say, a scholarship endowment, and it goes into that one big pool of $2 billion. And then our investment committee and our investment team allocates that $2 billion into a variety of places. So some of it might go into Apple stock. Some of it might go into treasury bills. Some of it goes, and $10 million of it several years back, by the way. So you're not incorrect, and the Times article was not incorrect. It was just not current. So at one point, we had $10 million invested with this Blocker Corporation. And then over time, the Blocker Corporation pays you your returns back, your investment returns, and is winding down and paying you back some of the principal as well. So we're now down to about $3 million on that.
And Mr. Smith, I have to ask, there is a question of the morality of this. On the one hand, the more that you can squeeze out of these investments, the more opportunities you're capable of providing potential students at Indiana University, the more you can help subsidize people's education. On the other hand, it does raise this question of, is the endowment backing principles that aren't necessarily best practices or continue kind of a system that allows people to avoid paying federal taxes?
No, it's certainly a fair question, and it gets asked a lot. And I think, you know, let me frame it up in a couple of different ways. First of all, there are a lot of investments we have that give us returns with almost no taxable income. So let's say if you buy municipal bonds, so let's say for Monroe County, if they float a bond offering to rebuild infrastructure, they'll pay you maybe 3 or 4 percentage points of interest. So 3% interest is more than what you can get on a savings account. But I think in many cases, some of those bond offerings are tax-free. Is that immoral? I don't know. You're getting a nice, safe return, and you're not paying taxes. And so, to me, and the way I think we see things with our investments, is that we absolutely will stay within the guidelines of the law. The government sets those laws, so the government said this was okay. So are they being immoral to allow an institution to get a tax benefit or a tax write-off? Are they immoral for letting us write off and reduce them for writing off our mortgage interest, for example, or moving to Florida, where if I live there 6 months and one day, I don't pay any state income taxes in the state of Indiana. The government sort of allows you to do this. So we could discuss that at great length, but the way we see it is the government draws the lines of the playing field out there, and our responsibility to our students, our responsibility to the university, and our responsibility to our donors is to make sure that their money generates the best return within those boundaries. But it's commonly used. It's the use of blocker corporations is just such a common practice right now, and it's common because, again, it does have advantages for the university and for students, for support of the university. And the government allows for it.
Mr. Smith, is there anything else that you'd like to add or you would like our listeners to know that we haven't gotten around to during the course of this interview, either with regards to the IU Foundation, the foundation's endowment, or with specifics to this case about the blocker corporations?
I think it's just important that people understand that we use the endowment not to make political statements or judgments. The endowment is there as a force for good for, quite frankly, the citizens of the state of Indiana to provide their young people with a world-class education that's also affordable. So that's what we're trying to do.
Mr. Smith, thank you very much for speaking with me this morning. I really appreciate it. If I can ask you one more question, I'm just wondering, there's no current plan to deviate from the use of a blocker corporation or anything like that on the horizon. Is that correct?
I don't know that I would call it deviating from using it, Wes. It's winding down. This is an investment vehicle that, like I said, started out some years back at $10 million. And over time, we get our principal back from the investment along with investment returns. So today it's at $3 million. And my sense is from our investment team is that it will continue to kind of wind down. But I don't know. We keep our eyes open on the horizon for, you know, attractive opportunities, again, that'll benefit the university and, of course, operate within commonly accepted guidelines.
Mr. Smith, thank you again so much for speaking with us. I really appreciate you taking the time, particularly from abroad.
That's fine. It's a delight. Take care now.
You too.
You're listening to the best of 2017 on WFHB. We just heard from IU Foundation President Dan Smith about the IU Foundation's endowment investments in the Cayman Islands. Former WFHB news director Joe Crawford brings us this next piece about white nationalist Charles Murray's visit to Indiana University in April.
Toward the beginning of his speech last night, Charles Murray thanked police and private security who worked the event. There were, in Murray's words, enough security to take out a small army. In fact, the Indiana University Police Department estimates there were 70 police officers from three different agencies working the event, in addition to more personnel from a private security firm, ESG Security. In total, security easily outnumbered the roughly 60 people who attended the speech by Murray, who is described by the Southern Poverty Law Center as a white nationalist. Police and ESG personnel were stationed at every entrance to Franklin Hall, where the event was taking place. They checked for tickets and searched the belongings of each person who entered the event. Officers were stationed in the front of the building, an area that was barricaded off to prohibit protesters from coming near the main entrance. Others were positioned on top of a nearby building, looking down on the scene. And inside, there were officers standing throughout the perimeter of President's Hall, the room in which Murray spoke and took questions for about an hour. Many protesters, including IU student T. Lawrence, took issue with the police presence.
I really don't care for their presence at all. They really don't need to be here. Like, no one's going to put their hands on this man. We don't care enough. Like, he's not worth us being in jail. But we do need to get a point across that he doesn't belong here and we don't want him here.
Lawrence was one of a few hundred people who gathered outside Franklin Hall to protest the event. Many held signs with messages including "No platform for racists at IU" and "Freedom of speech is not freedom from dissent." Murray is criticized particularly for his 1994 book, The Bell Curve, in which he attempts to explain social inequality through genetics. In the words of the Southern Poverty Law Center, Murray uses, quote, "racist pseudoscience and misleading statistics to argue that social inequality is caused by the genetic inferiority of the Black and Latino communities, women, and the poor," unquote. Speaking to a group of protesters before the event, graduate student Anushka Sen referred to the large security presence in explaining why she advocated a boycott of the speech.
Murray being invited to talk is not the same as discussing controversial ideas. It is inviting the very same man who came up with those ideas, who was invited. He had the security of the university space, of the goodwill of being a guest of the university. And it is not a space where people will feel encouraged to challenge him on his viewpoints. So it's not like a classroom situation where we take up his opinions and discuss them in a light where everybody has that freedom. It is bringing in a person who has all that weight of security behind him, a weight that is actually literally visible in front of us right now.
Police and security personnel stood mostly silent, rarely interacting with protesters, as the speech began inside at around 6 p.m. Outside, protesters played music, chanted, and danced on the side of Franklin Hall. Their words, including the simple, profane, three-word chant, "F. Charles Murray," were audible inside President's Hall as Murray spoke. Protesters gave varying reasons for attending the rally outside the event. Alyssa Beauchamp said she was happy to be part of a resistance based in, as she said, joy, community, and solidarity.
I think that Charles Murray has come to a place of higher learning, and his scholarship has been pretty debunked a few times now. Things like the bell curve. I understand that he's written a new book, but I think it's pretty hard to trust someone in their future scholarship if you know their past. As a woman of color, I felt it was my duty to come here and to at least show some form of resistance. I think that when ideas like Murray's are met without resistance, they think that they're applicable and that everyone loves them. You have the right to come here and say whatever it is that you want, but this is also my community. You don't live here. You don't go to school here. And I'm here to show up for the people who you essentially marginalize through your writing, who you claim are less intelligent.
As the time approached 7 o'clock when Murray was scheduled to be finished speaking, protesters spread out around the building with groups at each exit. Some said they wanted a brief chance to speak with Murray. Many of the protesters congregated in an area just north of Franklin Hall, where several cars were parked, including some police cars. When police tried to move those cars, several people sat down in their path, insisting they wanted to talk with Murray before they would clear the path. Officers threatened to arrest the group, which started as a few people but grew to dozens within minutes. Some officers told the group that Murray had already left the building.
He's not here. He left out the building.
We have every exit covered. Gone. Where did he leave from?
Do you think they'll walk out the back door?
Where did he leave? He's been around all the doors.
Do you think we would have him leave when everybody's standing here?
It turned out that, in fact, Murray had not left the building. Just a few moments later, he emerged from the other side of the building where other protesters were waiting. Murray got into a car and left without incident, but as he did so, police detained a woman they said was blocking a car's path. Not the car Murray was in, they say a different car. Officers quickly took the woman into Franklin Hall, pursued by a mass of protesters who quickly demanded her release.
Garbage! F*** you! Let her go!
Protesters rattled and then moved the metal barricades erected earlier that day by police, moving closer to Franklin Hall. In their way was a line of police who stood arm to arm. The group continued to chant for more than 20 minutes, gradually moving closer to police, who eventually backed up closer to the building. The protesters began using the detained woman's name, Stella. The group demanding Stella's release continued to grow as the minutes passed, and eventually it was announced that she had been released, leaving out of a different exit at Franklin Hall. But that did not stop the protest at the south doors of the building, as police continued to stand in line blocking the door, and many protesters took the opportunity to criticize police for going to such great lengths to protect a white nationalist speaker.
You're protecting a white supremacist! Wake the f-
They are white supremacists!
Yeah. You know, historically, just saying, I was just doing my job isn't a very good defense.
Yeah!
Police stayed mostly silent and later entered Franklin Hall, where they locked the doors. For WFHB, I'm Joe Crawford.
You're listening to the best of 2017 on WFHB. We just heard a report from April about white nationalist Charles Murray's visit to Indiana University. The Daily Local News is brought to you by MPI Solar, a Bloomington business specializing in solar hot water, solar electricity, and solar hot air systems. MPI Solar designs and installs solar power generation systems that encourage independence and individual responsibility. Found locally at 812-334-4003 and on the web at mpisolarenergy.com. Support for WFHB also comes from the Uptown Cafe, established in 1976. Located at 102 East Kirkwood Avenue, serving breakfast, lunch, and dinner, as well as wine, beer, spirits, and cocktails. More information is available online at the-uptowncafe.com. 2017 saw the opioid crisis in southern Indiana thrust into the national spotlight. A Lawrence County commissioner drew national attention when he quoted the Old Testament while voting against the recertification of the Indiana Recovery Alliance to continue operating a syringe support service in Bedford. Similar decisions from officials across the state led me to speak with Indiana Recovery Alliance's director and founder, Chris Abert, in this feature from November.
Tippecanoe County commissioners are expected to discuss the reauthorization of that county's needle exchange program on Monday, December 4th. As the Lafayette Journal-Courier reports, Gateway to Hope, Lafayette's needle exchange, may get the axe. One county commissioner has already declared they'll be voting against the program, one is voting for it, and another says they're on the fence. Gateway to Hope has only been in operation for about a year. It's the latest needle exchange to face county backlash after Lawrence County commissioners in Bedford decided not to reauthorize that program last month. One Lawrence County commissioner's comment, during which he justified his position against the exchange by quoting the Old Testament, was the subject of national attention. Chris Abert is the founder and director of the Indiana Recovery Alliance, a syringe exchange and harm reduction program in Bloomington. Abert says after repeated losses, the IRA is putting together a coalition of harm reduction organizations, churches, needle exchanges, and support groups, to combat the stigma and to advocate on behalf of the programs.
So harm reduction is a public health approach as well as a human rights approach to our social issues. So rather than immediately going to criminalization, we would look at a variety of ways to mitigate the harms done to both the individual and the community for any given social issue. So an example of harm reduction would be, you know, people wearing seatbelts, engaging in sports, but doing it in a safer way, all the way to safer drug use, safer sex work. So we want to apply that, A, because it's more compassionate response, B, because it's evidence-based. Most of the times, I don't know of any time that prosecutors are accountable for showing the efficacy of their suggestions, whether that's criminalization or treatment centers within jails, drug-induced homicide charges. So we get a lot of these ideas about how to address these social problems, and there's no accountability to as whether or not they work. So harm reduction says, well, let's actually look at the evidence and institute those measures. So what we're hoping to do is to create a statewide harm reduction coalition, because we know that there are a lot of people who are negatively affected and they just aren't organized. Oftentimes, what we see going on across the state with the closing of harm reduction projects is that people aren't organized, or they're so criminalized that they don't feel they can speak for themselves if it's an actual person using drugs or engaged in sex work. So we have commissioners going and hearing from their constituents, and the gist of that is you're going to go and ask the general population about one of the most stigmatized and criminalized populations in the country. The deck is stacked, 40 years of drug war, trillions of dollars of funding to villainize people who use drugs. So what we're going to do and what we're already doing, so we've already reached out and begun the process of involving religious leaders in various communities. So inviting them, educating them, letting them know what some of the options are to address some of these social issues. Next month, we'll have meetings with business leaders to do the same thing. And then across the state, reaching out to organizations that are already involved in harm reduction, not necessarily syringe exchange, because syringe exchange is one small part of harm reduction. So we're also talking about people engaged in medically assisted treatments like methadone, buprenorphine. We're talking about people doing alternatives to jail or diversion, pre-arrest diversion programs. And we're talking about, again, like churches that are seeking alternatives and more compassionate responses. And we're talking about people who are actually using drugs themselves are the most important to have at the forefront of this, to make sure that their voice is heard. Again, every person that comes in that we engage with is a person that wouldn't otherwise be engaged. Right, so we act as an access point to a population that is incredibly hard to engage with because of the criminalization and the stigma. So every contact is a success in that sense. But we also know that overall, the 30 years of conclusive data that shows up to 80% decrease in hepatitis C and HIV rates, who are five times more likely to seek treatment if there's a syringe service program in their community. And we know even things for law enforcement, like law enforcement accidental needle sticks drop by 66% given certain conditions like decriminalization of syringes. So again, that evidence is out there. And what's frustrating is that the people who speak out the most against harm reduction efforts, they literally have no research to back up what they're saying. So oftentimes you'll hear somebody like Attorney General Curtis Hill say, syringe exchanges increase drug use, therefore they increase overdose risk. And that is insane. That's classic whataboutism, right? So we see this happening at all levels of government now, where facts are ignored and people make false equivalencies as though that they're true. So constantly we have to fight all of this misinformation, a lot of which is being spread by people who, public servants who've been given a platform and power and have overreached that for whatever reason. Every month in 2018, we're going to have a harm reduction training, whether that's basic harm reduction or outreach methods, just on and on and on, for the public and also for people, most at risk, so they can educate themselves and empower themselves. And that will be part of the organization effort to get, again, the most affected and their families at the forefront. Just don't be afraid to vocalize the needs of yourself and of your families. As with other groups throughout history, there are going to be people taking great risks and putting themselves out there to make sure that these populations have their needs met. Not even have their needs met, but don't have the state standing in the way of them meeting their own needs. So there are very simple and cost-effective solutions to a lot of the issues that we're facing today. But we need people who are going to speak out for that, and we need policymakers who are going to be able to make what might be unpopular decisions for the benefit of the good. December 16th, we have a naloxone training coming up at Monroe County Public Library. This particular training will allow attendees to train others and to distribute naloxone themselves, so it's not just to use it sexually, so they could distribute it themselves. And the last thing is that there's Monroe County just formed an opioid commission, and it will be the job of that commission to have educational events like this, to put on a summit, and to make sane public health, compassionate policy recommendations.
You've been listening to the best of 2017 on WFHB. Thanks for supporting Indiana's only volunteer-powered, listener-supported, independent daily news program. You can hear tonight's full broadcast, as well as all other WFHB news programming online at WFHB.org. You can be a part of our award-winning news team. For more information about joining our volunteer team of citizen journalists, email news@WFHB.org. Stay tuned for Interchange, Bloomington Community Radio's longest-running public affairs program. That's coming up next on WFHB.
The Daily Local News is produced by a staff of over 50 volunteers
working in the WFHB News and Public Affairs Department.
Comments, suggestions, and story ideas
may be submitted directly to our news staff via email.
The address is news@wfhb.org.